Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And today we will explore further the current evolution of China's Belt and Road Initiative in light of the current geopolitical developments. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter, Zhonghua Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Joining our conversation today is Shui Gong, who is assistant professor in China program of the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at the Nanyang Technological University of Singapore. Hi, Shui Gong. Thanks for connecting with The Sound of Economics. How are you?
Hi, thank you, Giuseppe and Alicia, for having me here in the Bruegel podcast. I'm doing very well.
And thanks for connecting from Singapore. If I'm correct, you are over there now in this very moment, correct?
Yes. Yes, I just came back from the Shangri-La Dialogue, which just ended last weekend. Yes.
Great. Coming back to the topic of our conversation, the Belt and Road Initiative can be considered as China's most important soft power strategy on record. It was announced by President Xi in 2013, and since then, it has grown in economic but also political relevance. In fact, from less than 70 countries in the six corridors originally included in the BRI, the official number of members is now well above 150. In the same way, the projects covered by this grand strategy not only have increased in number, but also in complexity, whether sectorial or geographical. However, since the COVID-19 pandemic started, this initiative has received a major shock, notwithstanding the geopolitical confrontation with the United States and the current situation with the war in Ukraine. Shui, you are an expert on the topic, and I would like to ask you a provocative kickoff question. Will the Belt and Road Initiative be another casualty of the pandemic?
Well, I mean, there's background of this question, right? The COVID is definitely a black swan, and we've seen the declines, or at least, you know, the in terms of quantity that China's BRI in Southeast Asia, for example, is really happening. We don't really see much, or actually, we don't really see any new projects being announced in the region at all. However, with that being said, that doesn't mean, you know, China's support for BRI is being suspended because of COVID. As a matter of fact, because, you know, due to the incoming competition or competitive initiatives posed by the United States, such as the IPEF in the Pacific Economic Framework, we've seen that the tongs or the support for BRI is still being there. That's one thing. And the second thing is, with or without COVID, China's BRI has been evolving, right, in terms of its, lending practices, in terms of the target, in terms of the environment, in terms of the investment areas that China is interested. For instance, China announced the suspension or the suspending support for the coal-fired power plants for the past few years. That is really something, you know, different. So, I mean, definitely, to answer your question, the black swan pandemic posed a heavy blow to China's, global development initiative. But with that being said, that doesn't necessarily mean that China will walk away from this, political legacy posed by the President Xi Jinping.
Alicia, what is your first reaction to this panoramic from Shui?
Well, I quite agree that it's basically your question is, a strong statement, which I think marks sets the tone. I mean, from those 150 countries, some are hesitant now. I mean, some European countries in particular. And in a way, we do see much less investment, much less lending. I mean, all of that is happening. At the same time, as Shui was describing, the whole concept is evolving. The fact that apparently it's shrinking in size, yeah, in terms of lending or even projects, doesn't necessarily mean it will not be relevant. It might mean that it will be different. And the question really is, how different? I mean, what's this new BRI? And actually, I'm going to make a little bit of publicity, Giuseppe, because we're going to hold a seminar next week, 23rd, in Brussels, exactly on this BRI 2.0. And I think Shreya will help us a lot to redefine the idea of BRI, because I think that's where we are. I mean, as many other things in China, it's kind of a redefinition, which doesn't mean it is dead. It is just different.
Well, speaking about these differences, because I think we need to delve a bit into that. First of all, there is the issue of the investment itself. So you've seen there is a sharp slowdown related to the pandemic, but basically, what is the projection in terms of investment? How this investment will rebound or not, according to your forecast, Shue?
Well, in terms of those large-scale physical infrastructure, especially those hydropower plants or coal-fired power plants, in Southeast Asia, for instance, because this is the area that I'm more familiar with. Given the current circumstances, I would like to say there will be a slowing down pace in terms of that, not just because of the domestic issues in China, such as the zero COVID policy that strains China's resources from it, but also this region is actually reflecting on how to achieve this much more sustainable economic growth in this post-pandemic era. And many of the regional countries in Southeast Asia, they began to look at areas such as high-tech, digitalization, contactless education, et cetera, et cetera. So that will eventually mean investors, regardless where they're from, they have to, tweak their investment portfolios in this region. So that's one thing I want to highlight. And the second thing is, given alternative initiatives provided by United States and allies, or its like-minded countries like Japan and South Korea, they can pour out the strength together, to elevate or to expand the scope of the of those investments, that including the areas that I just mentioned. But I believe with the standard setting as one of the priorities in IPEF posed by American President Joe Biden, there will be more interesting, scenarios to be seen in the region.
And Alicia, I would like to zoom out a bit to explain our listeners the context as well from what Chue has been just telling us, because it would be interesting to understand a bit better the evolution of Chinese investment overseas. I think this is like the background that we need to provide. Can we say a few words about that to understand a bit better the situation?
Sure. So basically, Chinese investment overseas, if we divide into non-BRI, which is basically the developed world mainly, and BRI, has been coming down for both since the peak in 2016, which in a way coincides with the peak of BRI in terms of announcement is 2015, that's foreign direct investment. BRI isn't necessarily foreign direct investment. So China tends to invest in assets, in own assets in the developed world, and then it tends to lend infrastructure investment, as Shue was saying, in the developing world, mainly most of which is BRI by now. I mean, it's a big chunk of that developing world or emerging world. So that part, the lending has come down only recently. So, it continued to grow fast in 17, 18, and then in 19, quite a big slowdown, and of course the pandemic. The pandemic is, this is why your title on the death of BRI.
Yeah.
would be what you seemingly see if you look at the data, let alone people-to-people exchanges because of China's closed borders. But behind that, and I think that's the interesting part, my sense is that, yes, those are the numbers, Giuseppe, but is China using its influence with less? That's a key question to me. Is China, quote unquote, saving on the amounts needed or saving or, you know, using less of its financial resources for obvious reasons? China has its own issues now, economically speaking, and doing more with what China has at hand. So what I'm calling for here is somehow more leverage, because China is bigger, more powerful. Maybe China needs to leverage less to get more. And that, to me, is a big question mark, but I think a very relevant one for the world.
And Chue, do you have any views about this question that Alicia just threw on the table?
Yeah, I mean, when everybody's talking about China's outbound investment behavior, I couldn't help but think of, you know, domestic constraining factors that will ultimately affect these, you know, outbound flows, right? So I'm thinking, you know, I'm trying to also understand, like, how the dual circulation, especially, you know, the inner circulation that tries to, stir up the domestic consumption, that tries to increase the FDIs into the Chinese market, this kind of, you know, preparation, to what extent it will have impact on China's own OFDI behavior. And I mean, China gives us a very unique case in the sense that, for one thing, the leadership has repeatedly pledged to, you know, open its market, encourage its companies to go overseas. But we see lots of constraints, right? Not just in terms of the bureaucratic constraints posed by, you know, the lending criteria for those SMEs, but also for the capital controls, for instance. So we've seen some, you know, like market-driven behavior, especially by those non-SOEs companies. But to what extent they belong to the category of BII, it's really complicated, because some of the private companies, you know, in order to receive support, they are tapping on the label of BII, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it is the state level of project. But with that being said, what I wanted to say here is that those private sectors, especially those non-SOEs, they are now, at least in Southeast Asia, or for instance, in Singapore, they account for the majority of those active actors coming out, transferring not just capitals, but also technology. And unexpectedly, they also sort of like, contribute to the hiking prices of the property here as well. So that's one thing. And the second thing, in terms of the infrastructure projects itself, themselves, I mean, if you look at the latest, you know, announcements by Premier Li Keqiang, you find out China sort of like resume the interest in terms of boosting the infrastructure domestically. So I'm a bit concerned in terms of, at least it's very unpredictable to me to what extent the Chinese government is able to, you know, mobilize the already limited resources. And how it that is being prioritized for its domestic market, and how it will, you know, support or complement its overseas BII activities. The other thing I want to highlight is realizing those constraints, right? Beijing, I think, if I'm not wrong, this early April, Xi Jinping announced this global development initiative, a much more multilateral based development vision, and in the hope to tap on the United Nations, for instance, to broadcast China's idea of how to overcome the global governance issues. And in that initiative, what is different is it is that the tone is tweaked towards more about, you know, governance issues like poverty reduction, like education, and climate change and green economy. So that gives us some, you know, hunches that China's approaches of projecting itself as a global governance leadership is is changing, and to what extent is actually related to BII, there's no clear cut signals. But coming back to the point that Alicia mentioned in terms of whether it is being BII, whether it is being GDI, they are the same thing that China will not give up because of its ambition, because its aspiration of playing a leadership role in global governance.
So they will not give up. It means to a certain extent that there is not really a reverse in the strategy, but there are some critical points on the future, and there are a lot of question marks from what you both are saying, because to me it's really not clear which is going to be the exact balance between the more inward-looking new attitude due to the dual circulation, what is going to be the consequences of all these lockdowns and closing the economy. We've been here at the Sound of Economics speaking about what has been going on in the past few months with the COVID policy, and to me the picture is really not very clear about where the direction is going to be, and what kind of distance between the narrative and the things that are happening on the ground. So that is for me a very open question, if I might say. I don't know, Alicia, if you would like to complement something on this, or if we can say something more at that stage, or if this is really the open question that we need to wait and see in order to say something to us for understanding better what's going on.
It's hard to understand, on the one hand, China's retrenchment in terms of flows, and on the other hand, China's growing need actually for influence, because I guess China feels a little bit cornered, Biden coming to announce the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. I mean, China has a plan, that's BRI. And by the way, China is coming up with new plans, which adds to the complication, because it does sound like, oh, wasn't BRI enough? China's new plans are the Global Development Initiative and then the Global Security Initiative. So it's confusing, isn't it? Like, if you have a great plan, why are you announcing new plans? Is this a security, the latter, obviously, device that you're going to put on top of? Now China is reviving the BRICS. It all sounds like I need influence, but I don't know exactly which is the channel, BRI, BRICS, new initiatives, etc. So I guess the irony is, yes, China cannot give up, I think Shua's point. But China is a little bit I don't like to use the word stress, but somehow under pressure, if I may say, because of the U.S. Return after Trump. And therefore, I think China thinks BRI, but thinks many other things. So in a way, it's diverting, maybe I should say, diverting a little bit its interest from a single, strategy, clear-cut strategy, although it was a hub-and-spoke approach. Every country was different and still is. To new concepts to make sure it attracts enough interest, but very importantly, with less funding. So diverting the idea of China funding infrastructure everywhere to other types, where China's funding is less central to the equation. Because I think China knows very well that it can't continue to lend to the world. And there's been many cases. Yes, Sri Lanka, we'll talk about this hopefully soon. And I'm sure Shua has other examples. Some are not in Southeast Asia, but we have Zambia. We have, many cases of defaults, basically, or forced restructuring. So I think China knows that BRI alone with this funding needs is too costly. So that's why it's coming with. But I agree with Shua, without forgetting, China does need, clearly, given its size, its importance, global influence. So that's where we stand.
I quite like your point about in the moment where there is less funding, there is a multiplication of announcements of initiatives in order to keep the attraction with less resources. And if I might make a comparison here, we are not that foreign to this kind of strategy at the European Union level, because we are very good at announcing repeatedly new initiatives, you know, at EU level, and sometimes not necessarily with enough funding, or sometimes new initiatives are just relying on the same old funding of before. Why I'm making this point, because of course we are looking at China, but we are also looking at the role of Europe. We mentioned the United States, but I would like to bring into the equation as well the European Union, because they've announced repeatedly several initiatives in that space. One of the last one being the Global Connectivity Initiative, which should also be some sort of European response to the Belt and Road Initiative. So I don't know if either Shue or you, Alicia, would like to also have a word about the perception of, the United States perception. We speak a lot about it also within the geopolitical frame and so on. But what is the perception of the action of the EU within the space of the Belt and Road Initiative, especially because some of the countries are directly, targeted by both funding from China and from the EU?
Well, thanks for pointing that out. I mean, I think one of the effects or the consequences the BRI has been bringing to this world is the reactions by, either other major powers or middle powers. You can sense that the rise of China, means something to the global economy, global politics. Specifically in terms of the EU's initiative, this region in Southeast Asia there were some voices, showing the interest. Of course, this is very much in tandem with the ASEAN's way of doing things, for instance, diversifying, stakes, diversifying interests with different partners. And this region is really much inclusive in terms of welcoming all the initiatives. So definitely it is a welcome gesture by Southeast Asia. But this region is also very pragmatic in terms of, as you say, in terms of the differences between rhetoric slogans and the concrete actions. EU's way is definitely different, for a variety of reasons that the United States also share. For instance, they may be unable, to enjoy the mobilization of domestic resources to support those long-term and low return, infrastructure projects. But what is fascinating is in this region is in terms of areas such as health, such as technology standard setting, those areas are very much wanted because that will contribute to the new dimensions of economic development. With that being said, that doesn't necessarily mean the region will just look up to EU or China, right? As I mentioned, the diversification strategy. But in terms of quantity, so far, if you just look at the financing, or in terms of the projects implemented, or the projects that are finished, China still pretty much dominates the focus and interests of Southeast Asia. But again, it is evolving because, quite a lot of things changed. China has been changing, and we've seen the coming back of US. We've seen there's sort of like growing convergent interest in terms of, some of the Western European countries, or if not all EU members, in collaborating with the United States in setting the standards in the region. So I'm not surprised that the region will show more receptive stances towards those initiatives.
Thank you, Alicia. I would like to hear also your point of view, so that we have the European vision
Yes, I think the Global Gateway, which is probably the most relevant by now, is, of course, on the one hand, a response to BRI and in a way, smaller or, you know, like waning influence of the European Union in the world, but even in its neighborhood. So I think, you know, I would argue that this initiative, which is quite open, it's yes, mainly official lending with a vision of improving climate change or, you know, like green energy and other like digitalization. So very much in line with our own next generation strategy within the EU. So I feel like, yes, it's a response, but it's also one of a, I would say, like a responsible stakeholder operation in the global setting. I think it's for Europe to say, look, we are here, and we're also there for countries in need, and there's not only, you know, China and others. I mean, this is true for Turkey, for Russia. I mean, many countries are trying to increase their global influence. So Europe is saying, I have a different proposition. It's more open, you know, it has a different
objective. Alisa, if I may, yes. Sorry if I interrupt you, but isn't it a little bit confusing? I mean, I understand exactly the logic, which is we have a different proposition. But if this different proposition changes name every 6 months, what kind of credibility can it have?
I was about to say, I mean, that's the positive, that's the rationale. Which I think is well taken. I would not criticize the rationale. I think it's in a way one more contribution. You don't need to put it as an opposition. Some do, but you don't necessarily need to. That's fine with me. But you're right. The problem with this strategy is that first, it's come at the worst of all times because it was right before the war, and you know, in a way, it sounds like one more. Not yet, but could sound like one more failed attempt because the EU, and we know this from Brexit, Giuseppe, I mean, it's hard for the EU, given its constituency, its complications, its institutional setup, to focus on the external environment when Europe has so many issues. Yeah? I mean, we have the sovereign crisis, Brexit, now we have the war. So, you know, it sounds like a broken record to your point. But in a way, it sounds like a broken record because we don't have the ability to think. And a little bit, that's what's happening to China, going back to the point we made before, that because China is now preoccupied with its own issues, it's becoming harder than before. So for Europe, it's been harder since I remember. That's the difference. And the Global Gateway might not be relevant enough. It's not because of its design, although its design, we had a program on this is also quite unclear to me, but it's more like there is no focus now on this in Europe. So I think that's the problem. So it might well be one more name, as you said, hopefully not, but there is a big risk because of our lack of focus on our neighborhood now, given what's happening with the war in Europe.
On this note, because we are soon going to end up this episode, but I would like to ask, going back to, you know, to China, and of course it was important to have this view on Europe and on what was the responses and the other initiatives which are in this field. You mentioned all before. I mean, there is more and more geopolitical environment. There's more and more a use of those initiatives which at the beginning were really designed. I mean, of course, they were always a policy affairs, a foreign policy affairs tool, but they weren't so much connotated with a political goal. They might have been more on the economic side. So also to go towards the end of this episode and give us a broader reflection, how do you see the evolution of this tool, the evolution of the Belt and Road Initiative? What should we expect, basically, in the months to come, but also a bit more in the medium term for this?
Yeah, it is really dependent on, you know, it looks to me really dependent on the Chinese politics in the sense that, you know, what will be the political scenario, you know, after this autumn, where the party congress, the 20th party congress will be held. And that will mean a lot, not just in the directions, the future or the prospect of BI, but also in Chinese foreign policy and, you know, and the regional security or regional governance, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, if like what most people predict, you know, if President Xi still can carry on with the position, which most believe he will, the BI as already written in the constitution, as, you know, one of his most significant foreign policy legacy, they will definitely be carried on, right? And even if with reduction or with reduction of financing or with the tweaking strategies of the areas that China will be, you know, financing. And second is in terms of how China will modify its domestic zero tolerance policy. We've seen some changes in terms of how the central government has been trying to persuade, trying to incentivize or even punish the local governments, you know, for their respective lockdown strategies. But that is the area that we need to keep monitoring. So with those two points being said, that I don't think we can really predict that much. It's really unpredictable since, you know, the economic activities is really being politicized, you know, closely associated with the Chinese politics, right? And that's one area that I'm really concerned about. And the second area is that I feel the world nowadays is being toxicated by the geopolitics. You know, the geostrategists, they've been, their voices sort of, you know, outweigh the voices from economists, you know, from the people who have strong belief in global development governance, in collaboration. So the BII at this background, no matter whether it's BII or not, whether it is Chinese initiative or not, you're seeing a rising trend of nationalism, not just economic nationalism, but also tech nationalism. And you will see the inward looking policies from countries, respect of, you know, regardless of their regime types, whether it be democratic or authoritarian. So I mean, I may sound pessimistic. Still, I feel it's necessary to point it out. And the last point is, I think the middle or small powers, they need to strengthen their voices in those you know, regional and global affairs. In a sense that the conversations about development, about you know, economic growth, shouldn't be hijacked by politics.
Alicia, would you like to have also some final remarks before we conclude this conversation?
Yes, I will be brief because I know we're out of time. I agree with Xue. In fact, I was taking notes because, Xue, we have this event, and I think you are very wise on this theme because you have a longer-term perspective. I felt like, wow, this is really changing so drastically. You know what I mean? Like you see the data. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm an economist, so I worry that China is really moving out of many projects. It's just quite impressive. And as you know, around 15 projects only in Southeast Asia. So there is this, but you're right that on a longer perspective, because of China's influence in the world, it's hard to think that change will not be just an evolution, which I think that's where I want to end up with, that it's an evolution of influence, not a shortening of influence. And I think for the rest of the world, your point is well taken for Europe. We need to learn to live with that, but we also need to learn to find our space. And that was Giuseppe's point on Europe's global gateway. Not to confront, but to find also our middle ground there. Because if not, I think for countries, recipient countries especially, their bargaining power and their, you know, leverage will be very, very little. And I would end by saying less than before, because in a way, China, at least as far as financing is concerned, is ready to do less. I mean, and therefore the actual result or what you may obtain might be less. So the middle powers there are needed more than ever. I think that's the way to look at it, is that middle ground that I think we need to put on the table.
Yeah. And of course, we will have to keep discussing about this. As I announced before, we are going to have more episodes related to some specific countries and regions that are, of course, linked to the Belt and Road Initiative. So that's something that definitely will keep our eyes open and attention at the Sounds of Economics. So unfortunately, I have to say that that's all the time we have for today. And I would like to remind everyone that this episode was part of Bruegel's Focus on Global China as Seen from Europe, which includes our monthly newsletter Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. As usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Xue, Alicia, thank you so much for joining this conversation. I learned a lot about the Belt and Road Initiative evolution in the past months and years, and with quite a lot of open questions for what is yet to come. So thank you, and have a nice day.
Thank you, Jose.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Xue, and good luck.
And I want to thank all our listeners for following us. Until next time, bye-bye.